Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies and blueprints. I tell stories of what worked, but also those big epic fails that I've made along the way because I'm still on this journey. I talk to experts, I share insights, and all because I truly believe the teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And speaking of creativity, I want to share something real quickly. A while ago, I shared this idea of creative momentum. It's the notion that just forming creative habits alone can lead to stagnation, but when you combine creative habits with creative improvement, you get creative momentum. And I have co-created a journal with my friend Matt Miller. He is a graphic designer and an educator. And it is designed to lead you through 40 days of guided prompts and reflections, all to build creative momentum. It is available on my blog, so if you go to spencerauthor.com, you can find that on my blog. And it's available as a pay what you want download, which means you can just download it for free, or if you want to give us a little tip, you can do that. Or if you want a physical version, there is a hardback version of this journal. It's around 8.5 by 11, a little bit smaller than that. And it might be a fun thing to use at the start of the upcoming year. It might be something that you want to use or give a friend as a holiday present as well. So anyway, check it out. You can see it on my blog. It's brand new. It just released. It's the Creative Momentum Journal. And without further ado, let's talk about this idea of project-based learning and cognitive load. So it's 4:25 p.m., and I've been working nonstop since, well, around 7 a.m. this morning, maybe 6:57. Actually, that's not entirely true. On three separate occasions, I close my laptop, lace up my running shoes, and head for a walk in the brisk fall air. I absorb the sun's rays, which is rare for Oregon. It has been sunny but cold all week long. And I stare out at the red maples ablaze in front of the dark purple raywood ash. It is absolutely gorgeous. I'm not thinking about my projects or my lesson plans. I'm not thinking about the training I have to lead tomorrow morning. I'm being deliberately unproductive each time that I go for a walk. Except I'm not being unproductive. While my body is at rest, my mind is making connections between ideas, solving problems, and developing new neural pathways. This is especially true at 1 p.m., where I actually don't go for a walk. I take a nap. In each case, I arrive back to my work more mentally alert, more energized, and even more creative. These so-called brain breaks are a small example of planning my creative work around the idea of cognitive load. See, projects demand a significant amount of mental energy. And if we're not careful, we can hit a state of cognitive overload, which can lead to stress, frustration, anger, and exhaustion. So I want to share how we can design project-based learning in a way that actually reduces cognitive load for students. Someone shared this idea in an email blast that I sent out to my audience who subscribes to my newsletter. And someone shared an example that her professor had given, and I love it. And she said, you know, cognitive load is basically like if you're filling up a glass of water for students over and over and over again. That's great, but if they don't get a chance to stop and drink the water, it is useless. And you end up just overflowing that cup of water. And I thought that is exactly it, right? That's the notion of cognitive load. So what exactly is cognitive load? Well, I want you to imagine holding a 10-pound dumbbell above your head. For many people, that's pretty easy. It's what you do with a shoulder press or an overhead triceps extension. But now I want you to imagine that you're holding it for 2 minutes. It still might be possible, but it's starting to get challenging. Your arms are shaking, your muscles are burning. Now hold it for 15 minutes, an hour, 2 hours. Over time, even a small amount of weight grows unbearable and it actually becomes dangerous. Your muscles can only handle the weight for so long before needing a break for rest and recovery. Similarly, when we're learning, our brains can only handle so much information before needing a break. There's a lot of interesting research in the book Rest. It's one of my favorite books of all time. Actually, it's all about the value of rest. You've probably heard me quote this before, talk about it before, but it's basically the notion that rest is vital for creative work. The author, Thomas Opong, brings it up this way. He says, according to research, the brain gradually stops registering a sight, sound, or feeling if that stimulus remains constant over time. You lose your focus and your performance on the task declines. When faced with long creative problems, it is best to impose brief breaks on yourself. Brief mental breaks will actually help you stay focused on your task and improve your idea generation approach. A structured downtime can help you do your best work. We tend to generate redundant ideas when we don't take regular breaks. If you're hesitant to break away because you feel that you're on a roll, be mindful that that might just be a false impression. Your brain needs downtime to remain industrious and generate better ideas, unquote. But it goes beyond simply needing a break or getting some rest. Just as a weightlifter can only hold a certain amount of weight in their hands, a human mind can only hold a certain amount of information. Dr. John Sweller coined the term cognitive load to describe the amount of information working memory can hold at a given moment. Do you ever find yourself tuning out of a lecture an hour into it? The information might be good, but sometimes you just want to press pause and take it all in. Maybe jot down a few notes, perhaps think about it for a moment or talk to a neighbor. Ever notice that you tend to forget most information when you cram for a test? Perhaps you remember those college days when you slammed a few Red Bulls and stared glassy-eyed at a highlighted text, which, by the way, highlighting text is not a great effective way to retain information because it doesn't allow for any kind of deeper thinking about the text. It doesn't allow your mind to make inferences, but that's a whole different thing. But anyway, you cram for that test, and then the next day you stare at the multiple choice exam and find yourself wondering if it made any difference. You're tired, you're irritable, your brain feels fuzzy, and you don't do well on that test. Or have you ever struggled with certain confusing diagrams or with long, complicated verbal directions? You find yourself rereading that weird schematic with arrows going everywhere on another page, all with the hopes that you can assemble that armoire or that weird geschlabistor, whatever it's pronounced, the Swedish words for that IKEA furniture, right? It gets confusing, right? Because the diagram is overly complicated. And with each case, what you're dealing with is this idea of cognitive load. I created a little video. You can find it at spencervideos.com. It's all about this notion of cognitive load theory. But it's basically the notion that our brains can only handle a certain amount of information. We all experience information that comes in through the external world, and then that becomes part of our sensory memory. From the sensory memory, which is everything that we see, touch, smell, hear, taste in the moment, it's instantaneous. Some of that ends up going into our working memory. And working memory is what we think in the moment. It's kind of your conscious self. Here, the information is either forgotten or moved into long-term memory through a process called encoding, where the brain categorizes the information and it begins to make those neural connections. We can help ensure that information moves from working memory to long-term memory through something called a rehearsal process. If you remember back in the day, I'm going to date myself here, we used to have to remember phone numbers, and we would repeat the phone number over and over and over again. Or if you've ever paraphrased information or put events in sequence to remember them, that's all part of a rehearsal process. If you can kind of think about playing with information as you learn it, that's part of this rehearsal process. And then later, your working memory can retrieve it back from the long-term memory, and you have this ongoing process of encoding and retrieval, moving back and forth between working memory and long-term memory. That's where things like review come in. And I would argue that PBL is a great opportunity to engage in that encoding retrieval process. More recently, Dr. Barbara Oakley, co-author of Uncommon Sense Teaching, has introduced an approach based on cognitive science to reduce cognitive load through retrieval practice. So if you want to take a deeper dive into this topic, I love the book Uncommon Sense Teaching. There's a link to it in the show notes. Now, unfortunately, PBL can cause cognitive overload. So when you have too much information, when you get overwhelmed mentally, that is a sign of cognitive overload. So last week, I worked with an independent school that focuses on students with learning differences. We had an open dialogue about the challenges of doing PBL. Students sometimes struggle to get started. It can feel overwhelming. They look at this 3 to 4 week project with multiple facets, and it begins to feel like it's too much. And this is especially true with students who face challenges with executive function. It can be tough to focus your attention, think spatially about time, make those modifications in the moment. And for certain students with ADHD, for example, it can be really hard to engage in this ongoing planning, where they're planning their approach, they're looking at their progress, they're staying focused. It becomes a hard thing. In other words, PBL has this additional layer of cognitive load at all time. If we think about traditional instruction, a lot of the cognitive load is actually being managed by the teachers. But when they own the learning, there's sort of a shadow side, a darker side, which is if we're not careful, it can lead to cognitive overload. Here, students are not only thinking about the content, but they're also thinking about the systems needed to manage a project. In other words, they're thinking about the project and thinking about the learning at the same time. And for some kids, that can be really, really hard. And in PBL, we tend to have this notion of learning through the project, not after the project. So they're learning a lot of new information as they go. It's no surprise then that Dr. Sweller, the founder of cognitive load theory, points out that this notion of learning new content through a project can lead to cognitive overload. He's been very critical of this idea. Speaking at a conference, he debated with a PBL expert, Dr. Schmidt, for example, in 2016. And it's not that he's against projects, but he really has a hard time with the notion of minimal guidance. And that is often the case with authentic PBL. We don't want to do too much work for the students. And students who need scaffolds and supports, in some cases, might not get those accommodations that they need, and they hit the cognitive overload even more. There's a great blog post on this topic from Gavin Hayes. I linked to it inside of here as well if you want to take a deeper dive into that whole debate and sort of Dr. Sweller's critique about this notion of cognitive overload in PBL. So if that's the case and you don't want kids hitting cognitive overload, does that mean we don't do PBL? Well, I would argue we can actually design PBL units to reduce cognitive load. Now, what does this look like? There's actually a great quote from the researcher Martin in 2016 who says, these approaches are aimed at promoting learner independence while managing cognitive load appropriately, depending on the learner's novice expert status. If the instructor provides, and I love this, some guiding principles, prior information, signposts along the way, and scaffolds and assistance where needed, there is less burden on the working memory. And so I would argue that Martin is absolutely right. So is Gavin Hayes on this. We can actually design our PBL units in a way that reduces cognitive load. What does that look like? All right, so let's make it practical for a moment. Part of it is setting the tone ahead of time. That means letting students know what they're going to be learning about. This involves, before you do a PBL unit, take a single day to front load vocabulary for students and give them common language that you're going to be using as they do their projects. Spend a part of that class period doing a concept attainment lesson to make sure they have that background knowledge, that sort of schema to attach the new learning to. You also need to provide scaffolds and supports. So we'll be getting into that here in a little bit. But along with those scaffolds and supports, we need to have a project blueprint. While I don't believe in doing recipes for projects, I think there's a value in having a blueprint saying this is what the project will look like. Or you can think about it as a map. This is a map of our project, and we're going to break it up into phases that are going to make it more manageable. We're going to break those tasks down in the project. It also means that you're going to do some direct instruction when necessary. We can build prior knowledge through direct instruction. It might involve an outline of core concepts or a front loading of vocabulary. Often it includes, again, that concept attainment lesson. It can involve modeling skills. But what it means is you are including direct instruction at different times during your project. The key thing is they're still learning the content through the project. That is the anchor of how they're going to learn it. But there are going to be some moments where you step in and you say, here's how you do research. Here's how you distinguish between fact and opinion. Here's how you, edit a video and do some of this tech skill work that you need. So those are ways that you can begin. But I also want to share four bigger ways that we can reduce cognitive load in project-based learning. So number one, vary the grouping for individual processing and peer interaction. So what this looks like in PBL is that you involve individual and peer processing strategies into your direct instruction. That means when you do include that direct instruction, you break it up so that students get a chance to process information individually. They jot things down. They take notes. It's a little bit traditional, and they're getting that individual processing time. And then there's some moments where they paraphrase what you just said with a peer. They might do a short Socratic seminar where they discuss a core idea. So that's a starting place where you vary the grouping. But it also means that when you actually design your PBL units, you include both individual and peer processing time. So what does that look like? If you're going to have students brainstorm, you have them brainstorm alone first, and they're going to do an individual brainstorm. And then they share their ideas with a small group, and they get a chance to engage in that small group processing time. They narrow it down. Then they again have a chance to process individually alone, and they sort of individually vote for their best ideas, and then they bring it back to a group. And so what you're doing is you're honoring the need of introverts to process. You're giving some additional think time to some of your students who, for example, might be ELL students and need some additional language processing time. But more importantly, what you're doing in the moment is you're giving a break to allow for that individual processing time that then means that the information is moving from working memory to long-term memory. When they get a chance to jot down some ideas individually, brainstorm on their own, things like that, what they're doing is they're engaging in that encoding process. You might have them do a quick concept attainment lesson, concept map that they do as they're doing research. And again, they're making those synaptic connections in their mind as they make their thinking visible in a concept map. And all of this is actually a part of what leads to a reduction in cognitive load. There's a great idea from Freeman in 2014 who talks about the need for active learning so that students don't passively learn content and then just forget it later on. So active learning doesn't mean you're physically moving around, right? Sometimes it does, but it doesn't always mean that. He defines active learning as learning that engages students in the process of learning through activities and or discussions in class, as opposed to passively listening to an expert. So what you're doing in these moments by having individual processing time and peer processing time, it could be student self-reflection, it could be peer feedback that they're doing, is you're allowing them to engage in that active learning so that the learning sticks. By breaking up tasks and including that individual processing time, students get the opportunity to engage in that necessary rehearsal, encoding, and decoding. And along the way, they're going to reduce the cognitive load, and they're not going to hit that state of cognitive overload that sometimes happens in PBL. The second idea is to break the project into phases with guideposts. Have you ever assigned a three-week project and noticed that students spent the first 3 days goofing off? Tell a group of students that they'll be filming a documentary, and they might even say, I don't know where to start. This is too much. Give them a month to write a novel, right? Do an NaNoWriMo project. And some of them are going to say something like, this is way too much. I can't do this in a month. I can't write 60,000 words or whatever it may be. Students often hit cognitive overload at the start of a project because the structure and scope of the project provides too much extraneous cognitive load. So then they get anxious, they give up, it becomes a struggle, right? We can fix this by breaking the project into phases. So if we think about design thinking, the launch process, there's look, listen, and learn is phase one, and then they ask tons of questions, that's phase two. They engage in research as they understand the process or problem. They navigate ideas, it's an ideation phase. They then begin to create their prototype. They start highlighting and fixing what's working and failing, and they're engaged in this revision process. And then they launch their work, and that is a seven phase project. So there's seven different stages or phases. Similarly, you can work through this process with the phases of inquiry. You might use the engineering process if that's how you're going to organize your project. But what you're doing is you're setting it up so that there are stages along the way. And then what you can do is you can create visual guideposts. You can say, you know, we're on phase one, we're on phase two. You put visuals up. You might actually have the visual as a map, and you show, you know, we're in phase one, we're going to move to phase two now, phase three now. One of the best ways to help students manage the cognitive load on their own is to have them own the project management process. So they break down the tasks. You do this as a whole class into phases, and then they organize each phase in terms of the general task, the subtasks, the member responsible, the deadline, and their progress, right? And this can be done in a spreadsheet. This can be done visually with something like a Scrum board. And what you're doing is you're reducing the cognitive load for students by giving them a strategy to use, which is a project management tool. And you can use a Trello board. There's a lot of different options for this. I have a whole podcast related to helping students own the project management process. But understand that when they own this process, they are the ones who are also breaking the project down. They're looking at the guideposts. They're monitoring their progress. And now they can focus on the task at hand and just focus on their learning. And the upside of that is they're learning a valuable, you know, sustainable, essential skill that they'll use forever, which is project management. But at the same time, it's reducing the cognitive load. The third idea is engage in brain breaks. We talked about this earlier, but in projects, it's this idea of encouraging students to take breaks. It's what, you know, Thomas Ompong brought up in the book Rest. It's what I was doing in a full day of my own projects. And if we think about it in training, to use the metaphor of athletes again, they often do intense training followed by short period of rest. And that is the basis of interval training, right? And so the same thing is true in class. You might break up a project and have students go for a walk, do a fun game, a coordinated physical activity, a dance, a divergent thinking, you know, 2-minute challenge. But it can also be something that they learn to do on their own. They might say, you know what, my mind is getting tired right now. I need to go for a walk. I'm feeling a little bit tired. I need to take a quick break. And what you're doing is you're teaching them how to self-regulate and own these brain breaks themselves, which I think can be really powerful. And then the final idea, number 4, is make sure you're using structures, scaffolds, and protocols. Protocols can reduce cognitive load for students because although they have voice and choice and agency in their learning, the protocol is still telling them what to do. And so they don't have to ask, what do I do right now? They just follow the directions, but then they still have voice and choice in their learning. It could be something like the 20-minute peer feedback process. It could be using different protocols that you've done for, you know, brainstorming and for research. There's all kinds of different ways that you can do this. And using those project protocols becomes a way to reduce the cognitive load. It also means that you're providing students with things like sentence stems, front-loaded vocabulary for ELL students, and that you make those available to all students. Having anchor charts, resources, tutorials. My friend Mike Cackley, who co-wrote the brilliant book Pulse of PBL, along with Matinga Rugatz, they will talk about having students do workshops where instead of pulling small groups with kids who are exceptional learners or students with learning differences, what you do is you say, we're going to do a workshop on fact versus opinion. We're going to do a workshop on backing up a claim with facts. We're going to do a workshop on this particular math concept that we're using in our tiny house project. And any student can join that small group, right? It's just a mini workshop. It's going to be a 15-minute direct instruction workshop with a lot of guided practice. And what you're doing is you're giving students the scaffolds that they need, but they are learning to self-select the scaffolds that they think they need in the moment. And that process itself becomes empowering. In the end, PBL does not have to lead to cognitive overload. In fact, I would argue that great, well-structured PBL can actually reduce cognitive load because it leads to that active learning where the learning sticks. And there's a lot of research that shows that PBL, when it is implemented well, can actually lead to deeper learning and the kind of learning that actually sticks over time. So those are the 4 different ideas. I hope there's some piece in there that you can use if you're doing PBL yourself. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you tell a friend about it? Word of mouth is one of the best ways for people to find out about this podcast. And then also, if you're comfortable with this, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts? You don't have to type a review. You can just leave a review with stars. Or if you want to type a review, that would be even better, and I would appreciate it. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day, and go out and make something awesome.